This is Dissecting Dragons, the speculative fiction podcast for writers and readers by writers and readers.
Hello, and welcome to Dissecting Dragons, the speculative fiction podcast for writers and readers by writers and readers. I'm Madeleine Vaughan.
And I'm Jules Ironside. This week, challenging the system, how magic helps us deconstruct history, politics, and social issues. And with us this week, we're delighted to welcome our special guest, Nicole Glover. Nicole is the debut author of the taught historical fantasy novel, The Conductors, and she's going to tell us a bit more about it in a minute. Hi, Nicole.
Hi, happy to be here.
I'm glad you could join us.
And we're probably not going to be the first, but can we congratulate you on the release of your novel, which I believe by the time this episode airs, it's going to be on the shelves.
Yeah, thanks. It's exciting and it's a thing that came really fast and really slow at the same time. So yeah, it's weird how time works these days.
Yeah, and it's a weird time to be doing this as well. Definitely sort of mid-pandemic.
So can you tell us a little bit about yourselves? Where are you from? What kind of things are you into? A little bit about your background.
Yeah, I grew up in the U.S. My family is military, so we moved around a bit, but not like internationally. Stayed pretty much around one state, but different parts. We lived in different cities and different parts of the state for most of the time. And so it was an interesting. I always wish I lived abroad, that sort of thing, because it's one of those things you associate with being a child of a military parent. Mm. But I don't know. I had an interesting. I mean, other than that, really basic childhood. I spent a lot of time, reading and writing. I was a big bookworm, and that kind of led to my love of writing. Basically, I got lucky enough that my dad, when he upgraded to a new computer when I was fairly young, he gave me his old computer, and that's where I got my first start in writing, basically, because there was the days of dial-up internet, so there wasn't anything I could do on there other than like write or play whatever, some educational computer games. So I got my start writing little stories. My first stories were mystery stories. Which was surprising, because when I think about it, I spent so many years just being straight up like high fantasy, more fantasy adventure, until I found my way back through mystery with the Conductors. Mm-hmm. But yeah, I always have a bunch of ideas, a little writing different stuff, and it's funny. I collected a lot of my old stories, and sometimes I think last time I moved, I looked back at all the little notebooks and all the printed out old papers I had, and it's like, I was thinking, this is where I came from. For writing, and it's my writing's changed so differently of different focuses and whatnot.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, definitely.
So you started with mysteries, and then you really sort of got into high fantasy. What kind of like books or TV shows or movies and stuff like that were you into, both for the mystery side of things and the high fantasy side of things?
I read a lot of things. I mean, when I said I was bookworm, I literally mean I read like so many books. Some of them just fill time. Some of them because I was interested in. There's just so many different things, and some of them. I mean, a lot of the mysteries I can more vividly remember, and like a lot of the classics, Agatha Christie, Sherlock Holmes stories.
Yeah.
And there's just some more generic mysteries that I just came across through just reading, or some like thriller stuff that kind of came across in a lot of different libraries. And then a lot of the fantasy, once I got into fantasy, I went to, kind of hard to a lot of the main classics, even though I haven't read technically all the classics since, but a lot of the big ones that are particularly big in, I guess, the children / young adult kind of area at the time. Mm-hmm. A lot of Tamara Pierce, Mercury's Lackey. Mm-hmm. I remember being really big into those. Because I guess mostly because the library had a ton of them, because they've been out for a while. Mm-hmm. And, it's kind of consumed a lot of that stuff, because I guess the world of like fantasy and science fiction was always, I guess it's just different, I was a kid, I always wanted, like, why can't I live in a world with magic and robots and spaceships and stuff, like, why do I be in this boring real world that doesn't have anything like that?
Yeah, relatable. So would you say, has there been anything in particular which you think that has kind of like helped you develop your style? Anything you feel like you sort of you read and went, oh yeah, I really like that, or just something which kind of helped got you to the conductors eventually?
I don't know, it's more less little things. Some of it's like more like stylistic crafts choices. Mm-hmm. There was a book I remember reading a long time ago, a while ago. It was Orleans by Sherry L. Tepper, I think. It was basically, it was about it was inspired by what happened to Katrina back in 2005, 2006.
Mm-hmm.
And it was in the aftermath of a kind of like a world, like a, it was struck like by a bunch of hurricanes. But I remember, and one thing that stood out vividly was in the beginning, she had like a bunch of like, I guess, found sources, like newspaper clippings that kind of detailed what happened in the world between to get to lead up before the story actually started. Mm-hmm. Something I carried over to the opening of The Conductors as like little artists, like, you know, like little pieces of the world documents that kind of give you set the stage for what things are. So I can, it cuts down on me having to explain even more in the beginning. Yeah. And that's a thing I really liked. And I remembered it vividly. I think I read a book just as I was in the midst of developing The Conductors. That was basically, it was basically a historical fantasy mystery. It was like a psychic who works for the Secret Service for Queen Victoria or something like that. It was arts and history.
Ooh.
And yeah. And it was like, I think it was the murder mystery, the big element to it. And I think, because I was reading it around that same time, and it's like, oh, that helps me figure out the opening and just a general sense of how to set the world, even though nothing that the world of the book is really different from mine and focuses and everything. It's just, it was like a nice example that kind of had, because my genre is like, my book is like a mixture of different genres. Like when I did comps, when I was out on pitching my book to agents, I was like, It's like these two books, but these two books are just like, maybe there's historical fantasy, the other one's just mystery, and it's more me squishing together. And it's like making things, it's kind of like these two, but not at the same time. It has to be together at the same time. It's like, it was a weird thing.
Mm. Okay, fantastic. And, I think you've probably really triggered our listeners' interest. Can you tell us a little bit, or rather tell our listeners a little bit about what The Conductors is about? What is it?
At its core, it's me answering the question, what do people do after the American Civil War? Basically, the main characters were former Underground Railroad conductors. Mm-hmm. And they did all the, you know, they moved, helped people to freedom, going north, they helped, they did some stuff and during the Civil War and all this other stuff. But everything said and done, they like, that's, the war's over, they're settling down to their home. And it was like, what do they do now? And I was like, I figured in the world where they have skills with, the, you know, they have magic, they have skills, all that stuff. It's like, it's perfectly, it works well with, you know, solving murder mysteries in my mind.
Mm-hmm.
And so that kind of appealed, because I was always interested in what happens after for that. So that's the one thing that's set for the plot. But for the general, I think it's more me exploring what happens after what they do now. And some ways, the central murder of their good friend, it sets off things like, you know, all the changes in their lives, like they having taken a closer look at what they're doing now, what they want in the future, looking at their friends, looking at the community, and just, you know, it's with me playing around with having magic in the world, and this magic being more of a vessel for me to kind of explore the historical stuff, all some somewhat heavy topics.
Yeah.
And let me have a little bit of fun with it. Yeah. Writing.
Yeah. Cause I,
Okay. So, I was just going to say, you've kind of set yourself a really intense task there with where you've chosen and when you've chosen to set it for a murder mystery, because it's not so much, well, who's the most likely suspect and how do we get evidence? It's more sort of, how do we knock everyone off the suspect list? Because there is so much turmoil and things going on. Would you say that's a fair reflection?
Yeah, that's kind of how, I guess that's always how I view mysteries. Like, yeah, who's, That's to get rid of like the unlikely people to narrow things down. I guess that's always how whenever I read mysteries or strange mysteries in general, I'm always like, let's limit the options to get down to the main people. And it probably, I guess that's kind of the approach I take as I wrote the story, because it's more like just figuring out, getting through all the noise, figuring out what's the truth.
Mm. And the period, I've got to say, it's really, really interesting, because I think that when it comes to sort of fiction, there is a lot of fiction which centers on the Civil War in America. Mm-hmm. There is a lot of fiction which centers around, you know, slavery and things like that. But mm-hmm. there's this, it's kind of like, there's this narrative which just goes, and it was abolished, the end. without realizing, of course, yeah. that this didn't mean all problems were suddenly erased, that everyone was living in harmony, that everyone had sort of figured out exactly what the new, you know, what the new system was. This was a period of extreme turmoil and extreme uncertainty as well. So I think it's really interesting, and I really like the fact that you have honed in on that period, because it's this incredibly dynamic period which is incredibly underexplored, I think.
Oh, it most definitely is. It's, I mean, even just looking at the history books here, the Reconstruction period, the post-Civil War period, mm-hmm. is like a, you know, a page in yeah. these history books in schools. And it's definitely underrepresented in the media. Because
mm-hmm.
it's very complicated period. It's a mixture of like lots of hopes and hard-won victories. And there's mm-hmm. lots of things of going really badly.
Yeah.
Really quickly, and yeah, it's very fascinating overall. And the more I did research, I did a lot of heavy research, because I knew I had an idea when I came in and started writing this book. I had an idea of what this time period was about,
mm-hmm.
and the more I researched, more illuminated, more corners that I didn't really know about, or just kind of emphasized things, or maybe put things in more prominence and importance than I thought before.
Yeah, the other thing I want to ask you about is the magic system, which is really interesting. And like when I was reading about it, there was this symbolism in my head, which is probably just entirely me. So you can tell me whether I'm just talking right out of my ass, or whether this was something that you had in mind. But I really like the fact that it's based on constellations and stars, because for me, there's a sense of freedom that comes with that. There's also a sense of, you know, the stars being historically something which was used to guide, but also the stars being holders of secrets, you know, particularly when people were smuggling away in the night or you know, doing all sorts of things like that. So they are the guides, they are the secret keepers, they are the thing that unifies all people, because no matter where you are, you look up and you see the stars. So that's probably just me looking at that and going, ooh. But can you explain a little bit about your magic system and where you came up with it? Because it's great. It's really interesting.
Yeah, like what you said about looking up and seeing the stars are always there. Yeah, that's a lot of what kind of inspired me to go in the direction of using the constellations.
Mm-hmm.
I did like that they're always kind of up there, and there's lots of history of people using the stars
mm-hmm.
for navigation mm-hmm. and stuff like that. And I mean, in general, too, I'm a big fan of astrology and astronomy. Mm-hmm. So that was like write the things you like. And when I was thinking magic systems, I was thinking, like, you know, I love the stars, and I always mm-hmm. wanted to include mm-hmm. the stars in some ways. Like, you know what? Let's make the magic system out of the constellations. And that was like, it was perfectly fit for the story, I think. It's one of the things I kind of nailed down pretty early on. So I always feel like you got to nail down the magic systems pretty early on in your book, because that's, especially when you're making the story revolve around the magic, you got to mm-hmm. have it right. And so it's one of those things I kind of developed for, and I like the idea of it being kind of naturalistic, kind of more like an intuition, and like yeah. kind of like yeah. an idea that they can draw it, and I had to figure. And one of the things I thought about making some of the drawbacks, like, you always could really say, you know, magic has to have some kind of cost. I was thinking like taking the time to draw it out, having to be precise, or some of the drawbacks too. I think also have, like, you know, describe like some like a light glow comes from making these constellation sigils, so like you can't do it secretly that well, so that's yeah. like a drawback yeah. in there. And I like the idea also with having as a contrast to other brands of magic, because I had viewed this world as everyone can do magic, but everyone has different types of magic based on their history of different cultures, different nations, all this other stuff. And and so I like the idea of having it being a big contrast to sorcery, which is like the Western European kind of magic, where it's more rigid, has the wand, it has the enchantments, it's more of a typical, you know, that kind of stuff. And it's and it's a big contrast to what my main, what I consider the main magic system with the main, my main characters work with.
Which is, it's, I really like that. I like the symbolism of that. I also like that there's this prominence of the stars throughout, therefore. I mean, even in the murder, not to give away too many spoilers, you know, there, there's some star symbolism happening there.
I'm going to come in on the magic system, because one thing that sort of struck me that really, that I really liked was, yes, you've got this quite esoteric type system, and yet you've got your characters tying it down to quite mundane objects and occupations, and somehow that kind of makes it more effective in the, sort of the way they can kind of store magic for later. So was that something you sort of felt strongly about, giving it a more practical route as well?
Yeah, I like a, it was, it's another way of showing the different ways it could be used. And one way is it could become a bit stronger. I think it implied that if it's like, you know, if it's stitched into like a, this, like the clothes, for example, it could be stronger, more grounded, composed to, you know, just drawing it in the air. And it's just another, like another level of how, layer and level of how the magic can be used. And I just thought it's also just kind of fun to imagine that, you know, people are hiding their magic into like really mundane objects to either give it some, like, you know, making it enchanted, or this magic they can store to use later on, like a, I guess like a battery in that sense. I don't know.
That's, it really does sort of make sense, and you know, a magic system really should have its own logic, which I think you've accomplished quite well. Okay, tell us a little bit about your main characters, Hetty and Benji. I liked Hetty a lot, but I have to admit I've got a real soft spot for Benji.
They're the duo that came to me when I first started writing the book, so they're always planned to be linked together as a couple. And I think I leaned toward, I think initially, I don't think they were married, but there was, I planned a romance. And then I guess as I got into writing the full book, I was like, they should just be married from the start, because I love romance. I love seeing battle couples and being like awesome together. So I was like, there's always these stories where, like, you know, they get together at the end and that's the end of the story. And like, there's lots of more story after they get together. And so then, I kind of designed them to be kind of like a, they're partners in crime. They're also like kind of, they have a reflective from each other. Like they have different strengths and weaknesses that balance each other out. And at the same time, you know, they kind of do their own thing. Basically, as contrast, like Hetty's, for example, is a storyteller. Like, she knows she's big on oral stealth storytelling, but around the crowd, around by the fireside. Sometimes she makes things up. Sometimes she like draws some stories that she hears from other people and puts her own spin on things. Well, Benji is like, he's a bookworm. He's like, he'll collect. He's interested in any kind of books. And I don't think it ends up in the book itself, but I mean, he literally reads everything. He'll read romance to like dry histories and science books and anything in between, basically. And I like the idea of them having a sense that they always have an argument of like between what's more like real, like kind of stories of like the stories told in group versus like reading books and whatnot. And yeah, it's a lot of fun. I think Hetty was always kind of like the kind of, you know, tell it as it is kind of person. He was going to tell, you know, be more really harsh with the truth, even with their closest friends, the one that's going to kind of think first sometimes, but still in some ways be more reflective and things that are more personal to her. And like Benji's more the kind of the steadfast kind of like, you do your thing, I'll be there to back you up kind of person. Regardless, so they're a lot of fun to write with and kind of compare and contrast with their little group of like their friends to kind of mess around with.
Yeah, I do like their friendship as well.
You immediately interested Jules because you had one of her favorite.
I've got
one of her favorite tropes.
Okay, I have got a bit of a thing for a marriage of convenience that actually turns into a real thing, as long as it's not got the sort of creepy weird bit. So we're sort of talking Georgette Heyer type marriage of convenience, not anything else. But yeah, that sort of really worked for me too.
Yeah, it's also drawn the tropes I like too. Because I think it's always interesting seeing how people build a relationship or find something different in a relationship they thought beforehand.
Yeah, so. Definitely. I mean, they've obviously got this sort of very strong friendship and they've been working together for years. Mm. So the sort of, the suddenly sort of looking at each other a little bit differently thing, after they got married, no less, it's really intriguing.
Yeah. Yeah, that was a lot of fun to work with in the book, because especially when I got deeper into revision, kind of leaned in more into it, like to that kind of view. It was a lot of fun, and I can see why people like when they write romance, how they like working with certain tropes like that, because it was a lot of fun to kind of build certain tensions, and especially since I'm working just from one point of view of the character, because I had to do a lot of having let the reader be able to see Benji's point of view as well without. Without overtly switching over to them, because I think I always planned to conduct this be a single POV. So I think I was tempted a few points with I guess some of the interludes to switch to Benji's point of view, but it's like I was too ingrained with Hedy's point of view by then to make it work.
Yeah, I think the thing I like most about Hedy is that, as you say, she's this very forthright person, but. It's almost like she's not, I'm not going to explain this very well. Basically, she's got this sort of hard carapace, which is quite understandable considering everything that she's lived through. But at the same time, despite this, she's not trying to spread the misery around. She's also not going to pretend that misery is not there either. And that sort of freedom with her tongue is going to get her into trouble.
Yeah, I think also too, maybe with all the conversations around like, you know, strong female characters out in the world, I was very careful how I built Hedy around making sure she wasn't leaning into certain, like, it's stereotypical what's like, you know, what the strong female thing is, blah, blah, blah. But I wanted to make sure the layers and appreciate each of the different layers I added to her and to make sure I'm not just like, just throwing it in here, like, oh, boo-hoo, bad backstory, that sort of thing. You know, I just want to make sure it was a very vivid part of her character and kind of have that and trying to make sure it was shown different parts of the book were appropriate.
Yeah, definitely. Mm. So altogether, it's a when someone says sort of historical fantasy mystery, a lot of people probably go, oh, that's too many genres all mashed together. But when you actually read it, it's like, actually, that really works.
Yeah, I think it's sometimes it's kind of banding together. Like, I guess it's more at how closely you can wrap some things together. I think it's because the historical fantasy is like is an element that was kind of really tied together, and so like adding it's more of like it's historical fantasy and mystery, and like you know, so it's not like it's all three together. I don't know. I guess it depends how well you kind of scope out the world you make in the book.
Mm-hmm.
And
yeah, definitely. Okay.
Fantastic.
We're going to move on to our main discussion now, which is mm-hmm. obviously how magic can be used in science fiction and fantasy to sort of portray or help us access history and politics and social things. Mm-hmm. First off, though, I'm just going to talk about the elephant in the room. And the elephant in the room mm-hmm. here is that, you know, an awful lot of fantasy novels where you have a magic system and certain people who can access it tend to use that as the reason that those specific people are oppressed in some way or at a disadvantage, and sometimes that logic itself doesn't really hold water. So because you've obviously balanced it really, really well in The Conductors, we thought we'd have a little bit of a talk about that, because I think it can work, but it's got to be done properly, if that makes sense.
Yeah. I mean,
okay.
So I guess the big major questions are, when does this work? When doesn't it work? And I'm going to start off by saying that I think one of the main issues when it comes to the oppression of people with magic and things like that is that it is often used as a metaphor for, minorities. So... and sometimes historically it needed to be that. So let's just look at X-Men, for example. the whole mutant thing, you know, it was a giant allegory for the queer community, largely, which is why also in the films you get very typical, you know, like, you know, that they have the whole sort of, it's mutant movement, but it's pride and stuff like that. And historically that kind of had to be done because there was no, you were very limited in what you could portray in comics, in what you could portray in, on TV and things like that. But this has been a trend which has continued. And so it's about having this conversation, but without ever actually representing the people who need to be represented.
Yeah, I think there's an element of that. I think the problem is magic is also used as sort of a metaphor for any sort of power. So when you then take people who have power and then put them in a position where they're being oppressed for having power, that's a really mixed message. Or it can be, I think.
Yeah. Particularly if you're then trying to put it as a metaphor. And say, oh yes, so this is a metaphor for a minority, and I'm like, but it's not really a metaphor for a minority, because by your metaphor, you're saying that the reason they're suppressed is because they have powers, and it gets a bit confusing. And I think a large part of it is also because of the whole in the Western world, that the whole, you know, the witch hunts, the witch movements, you get that, you know. In America, you get that in, well, across a lot of Europe as well.
Oh, yeah, I mean,
particularly in Scotland.
Scotland kept it going until the 18th century. They did not give up easily.
No, they did
not. So about my ancestors. Yeah, we had several hundred years of it. And I think this is where it can actually work, not necessarily by looking specifically at sort of the witch trials, both in Salem and over here. But in terms of, yes, this is someone who does have power, or they have knowledge or something that other people don't commonly have, and it's made them an object of suspicion, but it isn't enough to necessarily save them or overturn an entire system. At that point, yeah, I think it absolutely can work, and that's something that needs, that's something that is worth pursuing, because what that is saying is that the system is not forgiving of any challenges, of anything that might sort of, you know, get in the way of its authority. It, you know, it's totalitarianism, if you like. So that can absolutely work. I think where it doesn't work for me is when someone really completely overpowers their oppressed main characters with magic, and you're sort of wondering why they're not just striding through the book like minor gods kind of thing.
Yes.
I think that's the case when you get to see... That's one of the drawbacks of, like, the magic at the price thing comes into play. I think a lot of, like, sometimes books lean into that saying, like, you know, they can't, like, just basically destroy their oppressors, like, worlds, basically, because the magic would kill them, basically. Yeah. But, I don't know, I guess the topic of how, like, things like X-Men and, like, other books and movies that kind of do the magic, people with magical powers are, like, the expressed by minority, always, I guess as I got older, I kind of found myself disliking them more, mostly because I found like some of the metaphors get mixed up a bit. You can tell that people aren't writing from being a minority perception, basically.
Yeah.
And that they're just mixing things up. Because I know, I remember a few years ago, the Disney movie Zootopia came out. And I don't know if you've seen it. It was basically like a predator versus prey thing. It was like, it's a really mixed metaphor thing that just, it irritated me, because I know what they were trying to do, but they didn't know what they were talking. They kept losing the thread of it several times over. And I see that a lot, because sometimes you remember a lot of these stories, things like the X-Men, for example, they're written by white men, basically.
Yeah.
And they're just having this view of like, they're seeing these news reports about happening to black people, happening to Asian people, happening to Latinos. And they're taking some aspects of it and trying to move it to their story without really understanding like how it works. That it's not just the hate being thrown at people. It's this systematic things that keep them from buying houses, from getting to certain school districts, from, you know, getting bank loans and all this other like minor stuff. And it kind of shows up, and that's why some of the things get really weak. And particularly with the X-Men films, too, they have these, yeah, these metaphors of, like, mutants being oppressed, but, you know, they cast attractive white people in a lot of these roles. I know one of the latter, the newer set, there was one of the first of the new rounds of the X-Men films, had a black man, Darwin, whose powers is to, you know, kind of stay, survive everything.
Yeah.
And he dies in the movie.
Yeah.
You know, his power literally is to survive anything thrown at him. Apparently in the comics, he's like, you know, he's faced death apparently, and he just, or he's something like, he was supposed to die and he basically became death or something like that. And so it's like, but in the movie, she like, he just dies from like a regular explosion. So you have those are the things that kind of bothers me when I see, and I start to see like in magic systems where, you know, the magic users, people with power, superheroes, all that other stuff become like hunted down because of their abilities. And it's just using these, trying to tack these metaphors to them just doesn't really work for me anymore. And that's, I don't know, that's probably, yeah, it's, and that's mostly in general. I become a more like leery when I see stories that have the Pacific go out saying these mages are being hunted down for magic. And it's like, I'm just tired of seeing this kind of story.
I think actually that's kind of, I'm just pivoting back to the Conductors briefly, but that's kind of where I think it worked the way you did it in the Conductors, because as you say, there's lots of different systems of magic, and you know, the one we're focusing on is obviously the one that Hetty can use because she's our viewpoint character. But also you're not, you know, as Madeline said before, it's not a case of the Emancipation Proclamation was read out and everything was just fine after that. There was lots and lots of things that needed to happen, and, you know, that still need to happen. And you sort of showed lots of different layers within the new society that was forming. So, yes, there's the constant sort of microaggressions from, you know, the white people who are around. But also sort of certain sort of classisms and things between the growing black community at that time, where people were sort of jockeying position. So, and that all sort of layered in with the magic as well. You know, there's a certain amount of suspicion from the people who don't have magic to those who do, no matter what ethnicity they have.
I think there's also something fundamentally quite interesting about the fact that you have these two, well, you have several magic systems. And obviously Hetty is using the swarm with the constellations, which is through its nature incredibly tied with nature, with the natural world. And then like a lot of the Western system of magic, this sort of this European sort of grown system, is very formal, you know, so with the wands, as you say, with these tools, with these kind of very stringent rules. And I like that as a metaphor as well, because for me it also represents the a metaphor for sort of, well, colonial history in general, but also the suspicion that is cast and the way that people tend to look down on the beliefs, the art, the literature, etc., of other nations, you know, saying, oh, well, look at that it's very rural, it's very underdeveloped. And no, it isn't, it's just different. It's different and it works in a different way. So like, I liked the fact that the big metaphor for me between this, you know, this stringent kind of divide in society comes not in the fact that people, those who have magic and those who don't, but rather the practices of magic themselves, which, stroke of genius, I thought that was brilliant.
Oh yeah, it's good to hear. I think that was kind of what I was going for. Like the, yeah, it was a lot of things I wasn't always thinking about directly, but it was something I was going for, that that contrast of like the no, because that was, yeah, in between like the kind of, yeah, I'm losing my thread right there, because it reminded me that the more derogatory term that comes from people who practice sorcery towards celestial magic is called primal magic. And I kind of was tapping into the whole versus nature versus more, I guess you could call it like an enlightened air kind of view of magic. And that's what the contrast I like playing with. I think if it's the thing I see a lot as well, it's just not just in this particular form, but like a different, you look at different cultures, because looking at different colonization happened around the world, and that shows up all the time. I think that's one of those things I kind of absorbs through, you know, this growing up, looking at doing research, just seeing these things around the world. It made it really easy to kind of play into that.
Yeah.
As I was making up these systems.
Yeah. Because it makes me think of, I'm going to bring it up. It makes me think of Harry Potter. And in particular, obviously, that the content that was put on Pottermore, which obviously came under a lot of scrutiny.
I'm sorry, I didn't mean to laugh. It's just that I kind of pretend that doesn't exist so that I can, you know, go through my day in relative tranquility.
But carry on. It was obviously, and very rightly, J.K. Rowling came under a lot of scrutiny because she was writing about, in her Pottermore thing, of when she was looking at sort of magic in America. It was very much this, I think she was Irish, I don't know, but it's just this Western person arrives in America.
Yeah.
And she sees that they've kind of got some ideas, but then using her own abilities, she develops this very base kind of magic and teaches them the proper way. And I was like, oh no!
Yeah, I think that's when I first started seeing that. That was like when I started checking out, basically.
Yeah.
You know, it was like really. And I think that kind of slowly got me pulling away from Harry Potter, because once I saw all that kind of stuff, it's like, you know,
keep it as an English boarding school novel. Just leave it there, yeah. JK. Just.
Yeah.
Okay. Moving on to looking at sort of magical systems, exploring history and politics. So my personal theory is that, obviously, this isn't my theory, but we learn via story a lot of the time, and the people that science fiction fantasy appeals to sometimes are not interested enough, or, you know, they can't access a historical novel or non-fiction in the same way, and perhaps, you know, having sort of some history and magic sort of all mixed together actually helps deliver the sort of, certainly the themes and things from history in a way that is palatable.
Yeah, I completely agree. I think it's also that a lot of people are very afraid, as you say, that they can't get into it because they're actually quite afraid of trying to deal with history. And so having magic, first of all, it makes it entertaining because, you know, who doesn't want magic? Who doesn't want to live in this world? But it provides a great platform to explore social and political issues whilst also kind of carrying people through in a narrative which is enjoyable.
Yeah, definitely. I just want to mention a book I read last year. It's called A Declaration of the Rights of Magicians by H.G. Parry. And it's set during the 18th century in three places. So you've got the slave plantation in Saint-Domingue. You've got William Wilberforce and Pitt the Younger sort of trying to get the slave trade abolished, up against Parliament. And, you know, they're actually up against a lot of classism at the same time as well in Britain. And you've also got the... You've got the French and Robespierre having their revolution. So, you know, there's a lot going on in that book. The idea is that I think everybody in, not necessarily everybody possesses magic, but no matter what culture, you can all possess magic. But certain types of magic are forbidden, and some are so forbidden that, you know, they send the magic testers out when a child is born. And if they detect a type of magic that's forbidden, they basically execute the child. So that's already... quite
That's
grim. It was interesting. I'll be perfectly honest, I enjoyed the book, but I'm not entirely sure overall whether mixing the abolition of the slave trade with the rights of people to actually possess magic and use it in a responsible way, you know, without being braceleted, basically, so that they couldn't actually use magic. I'm not sure tying those two things together 100% worked, but it was definitely an interesting book, and there was a lot of history and politics in it.
It's weirdly enough, I also think of Jonathan Strange and Mr. Norrell, which for me, obviously there's a fair amount of kind of social commentary, but one of the things that really interests me about that is that it's also about this history of rising nationalism and the fact that during that period of history, the Georgian period, then going into the Victorian period, this huge sort of industrial boost meant that there were lots of things happening in the cities, and rural communities were suffering because of it. And of course, this and as everything sort of expanded and new information came in, there was this massive identity crisis, which we've talked about in the past. And for me, it's the perfect metaphor for folklore and the way that a lot of cultural aspects, both from sort of rural communities and impoverished communities, were kind of doctored. So you have these wizards, these magicians in the story, but it's all theoretical. They're all theoretical magicians. They know the stories, they know the texts, but they don't know the real magic because they've never bothered to actually look into that. But it's not gone. It's still there. But it's also kind of exclusive at this point because it's been forgotten within rural communities because it's kind of been smushed down. And only if you have a vast amount of magic and stuff like that can you get it. But if I'm correct, I know this is definitely the case in the TV series. I'm not sure in the book. The first spell that Jonathan Strange actually gets hold of comes from this rambler, this homeless rambler, who he finds in a hedge.
That is actually true. That's what happens in the book as well, and it's a really great and rather snide look at sort of classism, which we haven't really got rid of in Britain. It's just kind of been a bit more subtle up until recently. It's definitely still there. But certainly at that period in time, I mean, even the fact that if you wanted to study magic, you couldn't study magic by being poor. You had to be very, very wealthy and have access to a huge library because you need all these rare tomes.
Yeah, and yet there's this sense that actually there's little bits of magic which exist, still within communities. And I don't think it's said explicitly, but, you know, there's definitely something to be said about this homeless guy being possibly a traveller of some kind. This idea that there's still this information is still actually held, but not acknowledged within the impoverished and rural communities where it came from.
Yeah. Talking about classism explored through fantasy and magic, Trudy Canavan's The Black Magician trilogy, which I think does it quite well. Have you ever read that one, Nicole?
No, it's on... I remember seeing it. I don't know why I didn't read that one. I remember, yeah,
to be honest...
Yeah, there's lots of books I'm aware of. It's just, I can't find... It's not in my library. That I just don't...
No, it's like... I mean, there's obviously hundreds out there, so it's... I just didn't want to talk over you if you'd already read it. But the bit that's interesting is that you have to have your magic unlocked in those books by a senior magician, unless you happen to be one of the very rare individuals who's basically kind of a natural, and then quite often an act of anger or extreme emotional trauma will unlock it for you. But it's very, very rare, to the point where at the beginning of the book, that's just a theoretical thing. Anyway, they're in the middle of what they call the purge, whereby they drive all the poor people out of the rich part of town and sweep them down into the slums at the beginning of the book.
Of course they do.
And, Sonia's just full of resentment. She's a teenager who's just, illiterate and grown up on the, she has family, but she's basically grown up on the streets and is learning to be a pickpocket. And she's just so full of anger and resentment that she picks up a stone with a lot of the other sort of orphans and street kids, and they all just normally bounce off the shields that the magicians create around the people running the purge, except she's so angry she activates her own magic and her stone actually goes through the shield and hits somebody, which gets her into an awful lot of trouble. But the interesting thing is that they decide she absolutely has to be trained in magic, so she ends up basically being sent to this academy to learn with other magicians, except they're all rich children, whereas, she hasn't had two pennies to her name. And there's some quite grim content there in terms of bullying and in terms of the way people treat those who are lower down the social strata than they are.
I think actually Trudy Canavan came up with the idea when it was, I think, for the Olympics. Now, I think she's Australian, and this might have been in Australia, it might have been somewhere else, but there was these stories about when there was an Olympic sport or something like that happening in the country, they were clearing the streets up, and so there were these images of homeless people kind of just being bundled into the back of vans and moved elsewhere.
Out of sight.
Yes. And that's kind of what gave her this idea of this purge. And I think the reason that The Black Magician resonates so strongly is because, as you know, as Jules said, and it's not just obviously in, it's not just in the UK, it's across, that this classism continues to exist, in particular in the way that people, the, I say in inverted commas, the undesirables are treated, the people who don't fit the aesthetic of a place. And I don't know what it's like in America, but in the UK they have all these anti-homeless sort of things in places, you know, around buildings. So they have spikes so people can't sleep there, and you know, it's awful, it's really, really horrible. So I think magic in that way can actually be used very interestingly, because I think magic in through that, through Sonia, who has access to power and has access to great power, introduces this concept in this world where it was all magic is for the higher classes. Magic is for the higher classes. It's controlling for the higher classes. And now it has this concept of, oh, actually, no, it isn't. No, it isn't. Everybody has access to it. And without giving any spoilers, at the end of the day, when the big bads come, it actually requires everybody working together on every level in order to stop them.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. I think that was very much the feel in those books, was the idea that magic was a right for all these rich kids, most of whom were like barely powerful enough to heat water, it has to be said. Whereas in fact, no, it's a privilege that you're able to learn it at your level.
Yeah. I think the other thing that the Black Magician trilogy did was they also introduced the fact that there's nuance to it. So for instance, you have Sonia, who's like, well, you know, these, look at these, she's very much looking at the sort of the middle class side of things and blaming them for the fact that you have all these people in the slums, all these people being pushed out, and then she kind of has to accept that there's more of a nuance to it, which is, there's a great metaphor in it, it's like the city is a person, and the guy apologizes, he's like, sorry for lack of a better word, but the slums and stuff are the boils on a sick person. They're the things we want to get rid of, but in order to do that, you have to actually, that's just a symptom of an overlining illness. You want to get rid of that, you actually, and make sure it doesn't just come back again. You actually have to look at the underlining cause of what's causing it. And it's nothing to do with the poor, it's nothing to do with the middle classes, which she does have, and everything to do with the way that power is distributed in the upper classes, and the way that the highest level, the 1%, are behaving, which I think was really, really important, and they used magic in order to be able to explore that. And again, it's incredibly topical for today, particularly also because in newspapers nowadays you have this whole narrative which says, you've lost your job, you know, you can't get work, you can't get, you know, the time of day with healthcare or stuff like that, it's their fault, pointing at other people who actually are on a closer level to you, rather than pointing right up at the top to that 1% who really are the ones who are kind of responsible for everything.
Yeah, well, they're kind of like, they're the stones, the slag and whatever that's backing up the drainage system, ultimately. Yeah. and stopping it all trickling down. Mm. Okay, looking at that was probably a really gross metaphor.
I think it's
no, that's a very accurate one. That explains everything. Every rich people, you know, we could have had better a bunch of good things if people don't hoarding all the money. So yeah.
So moving on to the more social things, we've obviously talked about, you know, the fact that magic can be useful as a metaphor for when you can't openly discuss things and, you know, preserve your safety. So, which was kind of what triggered the original X-Men comics and things, although let's be honest, some of that is a bit dated now. Magic, and, you know, we've just talked about the Black Magician, magic being a great equalizer. You can have someone raising from very humble origins and going head to head with the regime, or, you know, through the way they act, sort of re-educating people, which is probably the better way to go head to head with the regime. Definitely. I don't want to like bring up a book that was controversial just for the sake of it, but it is something that Laurie Forrest does in The Black Witch, which, you know, I think kind of suffered from the fact that she put every single type of prejudice you can possibly imagine into that book. And when the early arcs came out, people kind of misread some of it. And I'll be honest, when I read the book, I found that constant stream of hatred of every kind really exhausting to read. So God knows what it was like for somebody who, you know, genuinely had suffered from sort of racial microaggressions, etc. That would have been, you know, obviously it depends on the reader. But I will say that in terms of going from someone who's kind of wedded to one system because that's what they've been brought up to believe and being quite naive and not being able to sort of really question things, and then through the book learning to question things and see things a little bit more clearly, it does do that quite well. I think there are probably other books since then who might have done it better, but that was the one that sort of bounced to mind. Okay, magic can also act as a mirror for things that are still broken in society. So we spoke to, actually, I think it was not quite this time last year, but we spoke to Veronica Roth about her new book, back then, Chosen Ones. And, you know, what we kind of liked, I'm speaking for you now, Madeline, so correct me if I'm wrong. What we kind of liked about Chosen Ones was the fact that it's set after, you know, everything, you know, after the big bad's been defeated, etc., years later when the kids have grown up, and you realise just how terribly they're being treated by the rest of, I mean, they're basically recruited as child soldiers because they had access to this magic, and then were given this lump sum payoff afterwards, and then no support, and they're all like, they're all suffering from PTSD well into their 20s.
That's something I always thought about when we have all these stories about these child heroes, especially all these young adult fantasies. It's like all these, you know, the kids, the burden of saving the world, and, you know, all these traumas, they're leading armies, they're, you know, performing assassinations and all this other, all these terrible things. And, you know, they're thinking like, how do they deal with this? Like, you know, 5 years later. And it's like, because you think about, when you're in that age group for young adult fantasy, you're thinking, oh, it's someone like me, you know, taking down the bad guy. But as an adult, you know, looking at back, these kids are like the burden of saving the world. It's like, it's a little bit harder sometimes to read some of like, you know, all these younger books geared for younger people. Thinking, like, all these trauma they must be dealing with, you know, like how it's so terrible. Why are we putting this burden on these young kids? And I don't know. It's a thought I had, so I think it was a fascinating choice with that book. Even though I haven't read it yet, the choice of, like, you know, doing the aftermath of the Chosen Ones, like how they deal with.
Yeah, definitely. It's the I suppose it's very like sort of having a child who hits superstardom very, very early on in their lives, and then sort of like suddenly there are all these mean videos of them in their mid-20s when they're sort of, I know, getting drunk and they've put on a bit of weight and they started smoking pot or what have you. And it's like, well, of course they have. They're dealing with this trauma.
Yeah. All these child actors that kind of, you know, they blew up as, you know, when they're like cute little 8-year-olds, then they disappear because, they're basically bullied by people, especially now with social media. Because I think I remember reading stories about, like, younger, child actors of the 80s and 90s, and they went through a bunch of stuff. And now think about nowadays.
Yeah.
Oh my gosh. It's terrible.
Yeah, I mean,
People are terrible.
You look at Robert Downey Jr., for instance, you can kind of understand why he got into the state that he did later on when you look at his childhood and kind of what he was put through. But I mean, the other thing that it really makes me think about is that, and I know this is the case in the US and it's definitely the case in the UK, there is a proportion of homeless people who are ex-military. And there is this great emphasis put on our
Oh
heroes,
yes. Oh
our
yes.
heroes that are, look at them, look how brave they are. And then when they come home, no support, nothing for them. They're just kind of, once you're no longer in the army, you're just kind of left to it. And regardless of whether you've experienced something, like regardless of whether you were a prisoner of war or whether someone died or anything like that, you've also been trained up in a certain system, in a certain way of life, usually from quite a young age. I mean, they recruit people from a very, very young age. So imagine being sort of 18 and then going into the army and then being ejected back into society after a very rigid, situation, where you might very well have watched people die, where you had to make decisions where people died, where you would have been traumatized to a certain extent also in order to learn the skills to survive. And then you're just on your own. That there's nothing left for you. And in the UK, we do have, obviously we have free healthcare, so you do, people can access certain things. But at the same time, I've known people who have come out of the army and then floundered for years, even with the kind of the emotional support, because they didn't know what to do. And for me, that the Chosen Ones, Veronica Roth's Chosen Ones, really helped put that forward with the whole magic thing, because obviously we do that all the time, and we treat these magic stories in the same way that we treat our soldiers in the look at them, look at how amazing, all this media attention on them, all this, oh, remembrance, we're gonna lay down the poppies and stuff like that. And I'm like, but what about the people who are left? Where's all the focus on them? And you pass them over. You don't want to think about the person who now has a drinking problem, who now has a drug problem, who's committed suicide. And if they commit suicide, it's then, oh, what a shame. If you're ever in trouble, reach out. To who? To who? What support are you giving these people? So, and I think there is this big thing about, where we focus our attention and the kind of things we'd like to focus our attention on. And ignoring all of the ugly repercussions that come with that.
Yeah, definitely. I think it's a sort of theft in a way, isn't it? Because you're not allowing them to be whole people in the first place who can be fallible. No one really wants to deal with the hero when they're not doing something heroic or there's not a parade on. Okay, so magic systems in fantasy allow us to tackle big questions like nature versus nurture, who actually deserves to hold power? Is being a chosen one just a different form of elitism? Or is it what you do with the cards you're dealt? So, final thoughts on that from people.
I think ultimately it really depends on how it's done, doesn't
It
it?
does. And we were talking earlier about how magic as a metaphor for being a minority of some kind and being oppressed often doesn't work because people have not thought things through and they've not really tried to change the perspective of the characters and they've not done their due diligence, which is why it doesn't work in those instances. I think it's kind of, as you say, the same thing. It's great to have a magic system and say, well, I want everybody to be able to either make lightning or fireballs or what have you, but you've got to think about what you're saying with the magic system you're creating, I guess.
Yeah, the thing is that I think that the problem is that for some people, and this is where I think there's been sort of large arguments within the fantasy community, some people are just doing thought experiments. Some people are just thinking, they're not trying to write metaphors. they're doing it unintentionally, and it's because they have been feeding on this work, which has been full of metaphors. So they are just thinking of it in terms of, no, this is nothing to do with minority people. This is just to do with XYZ. This is just a thought experiment, without realizing, obviously, that there's this entire, or acknowledging that there's this entire history that comes with it. And I think nowadays, unless you are very clever about how you do your thought experiment, or unless you do this thought experiment and then very obviously have a very diverse cast to show this isn't a metaphor, you fall under a lot of scrutiny. So you do need to appreciate what has been written before, what it means, and how, once again, X-Men, good for the period, excellent for the period that it was being written in, excellent to discuss the things that no one wanted to talk about and to make people sort of empathize and rethink situations. In the modern day, it needs to be changing, it needs to be adapting. And I think the problem is that in the modern day, they've let go of a lot of the "this is a metaphor," but they haven't then updated it to say, we're going to show it's not a metaphor by having a much more diverse cast, etc. So it's still a metaphor, it's just a really bad one. Those are my thoughts on the
not to put you on the spot, Nicole, but do you have anything you want to add to that?
Yeah, I think I agree. It's like, it's tied to how well you craft it together. I think there's, that's the point where, like, different and diverse viewpoints come into view, because there's lots of ways you can do stories where, you know, there's a certain group of people who have only magic, or you have chosen ones, and do a little bit something different that kind of tackles some of the inherent issues that kind of arise for certain things. I know, well, there's like one thought, like, you know, there's a thought of, like, you know, a magic that's capacity to bloodlines being, like, you know, genetics, you know, eugenics, basically, side of it. You look at it really closely and stuff like that. But looking at, it's just different diverse points will kind of start to eliminate some issues that kind of arise from these old, well-known, well-loved of fantasy ideas and tropes, and kind of craft something, do something different with them. Because there's, I mean, I do love a good Chosen One story. I want to see a different kind of type of Chosen One in that kind of story.
Yeah.
Thinking about not just, like, the person who is the Chosen One, but, like, what that Chosen One's role function as. I don't know. Mm. I think it's the same way I kind of view prophecies. Like, you know, I'm always a big fan of prophecies that go, like, they're misinterpreted, basically. They're not, like someone gets it wrong, like this vague poetry thing. Someone thinks it's one thing, but it turns out to be something else. That all this other stuff, and there's ways to kind of explore different. There's different ways to do different things. I'm very curious about what people can kind of come with. Because there's tropes persist for certain reasons. Because they have a lot of elements that are really good building blocks. But with anything, you know, you can kind of take it, twist certain things, make things on your own. And I guess in general, just thinking of like a broader view of certain things. Different experiences kind of work with, and just sometimes it takes a step back to look at what you're talking about and see what it could be implied to other things, and maybe it might not add to the story, but it'll help definitely add to the reader's experience. I think, because people are expecting more nuanced approach to different things nowadays.
Definitely,
absolutely, yeah. But I'm with you. I love a self-fulfilling prophecy as well. I love the sort of the Greek thing, which is they're like, your son will kill you. Aha! I shall then throw my son into the sea. Years later, he returns.
Having been raised on a small island somewhere. Yeah, I love the ones where if you just left well enough alone, it wouldn't have ever happened.
I saw someone who did a great, great one, which was the prophecy was, your son will kill you. And and everyone's like, well, you must murder your son. And he goes, no, if he kills me, so be it. I will raise him because he's still my son and I still love him. And he raises it, and years go by, and it's a loving, you know, loving parent-child relationship. He raises this excellent, strong son, and the king is getting older, and so he's like, I can no longer manage. I'm getting sick now. I can no longer manage my kingdom, so I will let my son be king. And then he's dying, and he's in incredible pain. And he sort of looks at his son and says, "Please, can you relieve my pain?" And his son, with tears in his eyes, goes, "Yes, father." and quietly euthanizes him into the night. And I was like, yes!
Yeah, those are like the best kind of stories, a different way to interpret words. Because that's the thing with language. Like, you know. Mm. Yeah, I like that.
Yeah, definitely. Yeah. Okay, so a couple of examples of our personal favourite magic systems. You know, we do a couple of these when we have a guest episode because I'm always really curious what other people think. So we just sort of do one and we'll go around the circle, as it were, a couple of times. So who'd like to go first?
why don't you start us off? Okay,
I'm a real sucker for any kind of magic system that's based on language or words. So I absolutely love Garth Nix's Charter Magic in the Apporson series, where it's like a magical alphabet, but learning to put that alphabet together gives you more and more complex magical spells. So basically anyone can do it, but you have to learn. So I guess it's kind of like learning an ancient language.
Yeah. I do like that. Yeah. I like that concept. I've got to say, well, because we mentioned the Black Magician trilogy, so maybe I'll come back to that in a little bit. But I actually really like the magic system in Leah Bardugo's Grisha series. Also, I think the reason I like it is that obviously you've got these different sort of categories of people who can perform different types of magic. So you have the fabricators and stuff like that. And I thought that that was really original and new and a little bit different, rather than it just being elemental stuff or different things that you kind of had particular things which you could manipulate. So I really, really liked that. So, yeah, I would probably say the Grisha series from Leah Bardugo.
Cool.
What about
I'm
you?
I'm trying to think of the name for it. I think it's a series I remember really liking. It was Sharon Shin's 12 Houses series. It had a shapeshifter. Mm. It had a lot of... I remember there was a lot of moon elements. There was one, the character who's got the powers from the sun. And there was one book. It had different powers from the moon. Because it was kind of a quasi-religion thing going on, too. Because I remember there was some of the moon magic was tied to... Because they had, like, moon priestesses that had, like, powers from full moon and a new moon and all this other stuff.
Yeah.
But it was like, I remember liking this one of the systems because it was a little bit different. I think it was one of the... Well, I think each book that kind of sort of focused around different types of magic styles, But it was, I guess it was the first time it was like, even though it felt like the magic was integrated into the world a bit. That's one of those things I remember liking a lot. It had a lot of this, and it had the celestial elements to it, so that's probably the reason why it stuck with me.
You got another one?
Yeah, I'll just mash these two together, but I read Foundry Side by Robert Jackson Bennett a little while back, and it's a sort of steampunky type universe, but part of getting the machines and things to actually work, including things like, you know, if somebody has brain surgery and they have a metal plate put in their head, part of getting it to work is having these little engravings put on the metal or what have you. So I can't remember exactly what he calls them, but it is, again, a little bit like the Charter Magic, except it's written down. So I really like that. I also really like... These are all language-based, so yeah, this is clearly my bag. Prospero's Children by Jan Segel, which the magic is based around the language of Atlantis. Way back in the past, when Atlantis was still a thriving land above the waves, there was a sort of cataclysmic cosmic event which changed how the people in Atlantis developed. And the language that grew up around that took on a special resonance and power of its own. And then certain people still have this kind of sleeping aspect to their physical bodies. And those who manage to sort of wake up that power can use the magical language to a certain extent. I mean, it really depends how much of it you've got. So I like that as well, because it's got a very folklore-y feeling, but it's still language-based.
Mm. Ooh, you know, I like that folklore-y feeling. I hear folklore and I rise from my grave. No. I think... Okay, I'm just going to be totally self-centered here and say I just happen to like the magic system I came up with in the Hamartia cycle. I'm going to say it because I do like it. I like the fact that obviously depending, the humans have their own magic. It's an elemental magic, which they draw from the stars. And so the stars have elemental powers, and depending on what star is ahead at certain times, you can draw on certain elements at any given time.
And what star you're born under as well, isn't it?
And yeah, what star you're born under will help you make a sort of certain preference. So if you're born under a fire star, you're always going to be better with fire, and you'll probably be quite weak with water. But you can technically use them all. But learning to use them is actually, it's kind of like advanced mathematics. So you do need to go to school. You can read books about it. So technically someone from a working class, as long as they could read, could learn to do it. But learning, self-teaching how to do magic is incredibly difficult, at least advanced magic, which is why they have these magi who are basically like PhD students. They have gone through the entire schooling, and then once they've gotten past a certain level, they have access to all of this incredible, amazing knowledge, which means that they can't, that they're no longer just, right, I can happen to make a fire. It's, I can now, make a tree grow because I understand all of the elemental components that are required and what measures and stuff like that in order to make this tree grow. And they can heal and stuff like that. They can do all this amazing stuff. So technically, it's this whole thing of you can do it, but in order to do it, from a lower class level, you need to be self-taught because the academy is expensive to get into, which means that only people who have a certain amount of money can get it. But technically it's open to whoever wants to do it, as long as you can pay to do it. So yeah, I like my magic system. I think it makes sense.
Well, that is the important thing about magic system. Do you have another example, Nicole?
Yeah, Daniel Jose's older system from the Shadow Shaper, which is, it involves a lot of kind of drawings, basically, like some of the chalk drawings, paint drawings, that basically come to life and do certain things. And that was one of the systems the main characters worked with, and there's other ones that kind of come in there that I'm blinking out of, but remember it being tied with, there's a set of tarot cards that, or a version of, it seems like tarot cards, in the sense that become very, very very prominent in the book series as well. But that was the kind of the first time I came across, and within books, of people drawing stuff and things coming to life, which I really liked.
That sounds very cool. Name too many books I actually haven't read.
You have excited Jules.
Yes. You've woken the beast. Right, yes. Well, we have overrun very, very slightly, but we're doing quite well for us. So
we are. Before we go, Nicole, would you like to tell our listeners where they can find you online?
Okay, the main places you'll find me online is first at my website, nicole-glover.com. And you can find me on Twitter. My Twitter handle is basically, it's my name, except that it's Nicole Glover with no spaces, but instead of the V, I replace it with a W. Because... Right. Yeah.
Right.
Little.
Okay.
Okay. Great.
Thank you. Fantastic. So do check out Nicole's online presence. Have a look at the conductors, which should be released by the time this episode comes out. It goes without saying that our Dissecting Dragons recommendation of the week is, of course, the conductors. So do check it out, and remember that you can get in touch with us via our Facebook, our Tumblr, and our Twitter, both individually and as our under our Dissecting Dragons page. Let us know what you think, Have you read The Conductors? Have you enjoyed it? And also, what about magic systems? Is there a magic system that you particularly like? Do you have any opinions about what we've been talking about today? Do get in contact. For now, all that's left to say is thank you very much, Nicole, for joining us.
Yes, thank you. Great talking with everybody.
Yeah, it's been great. It's been really fascinating to find out your process behind making the conductors, writing The Conductors, which has been definitely one of the more unusual books in terms of how it's sort of put together. So I really enjoyed reading that. Thank you.
Thanks for saying that. It's great to hear.
Okay, guys. We'll catch you guys next week. Bye-bye.
Thanks and goodbye.
Bye.
You've been listening to Dissecting Dragons, the speculative fiction podcast. You can follow our podcast at podbean.com or from iTunes. For more information, visit our Facebook page at www.facebook.com/dissectingreaders or check out our author websites at jaironside.com and madelinevaughan.com. Please note, no dragons were harmed during the making of this podcast.